from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The U.S. bishops met in Baltimore this last week with the clergy abuse crisis on the top of their agenda. The week ended with controversy, disappointment, and frustration as they failed to enact any proposals for dealing with the scandal. What happened? We talk with Register contributor Father Raymond D'Souza. I'm Matthew Bunsen, the Register senior editor and co-host for Register Radio. I'm filling in for Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio, while she's away on maternity leave. Mom and new baby are doing just fine, but please keep them all in your prayers. Well, the U.S. bishops held their annual fall meeting this week, and the task for them was recovering their credibility in dealing with the crisis of clergy abuse. It proved a week of failure and disappointment, as first the Vatican asked that they not vote on any major steps until after the meeting in Rome in February, when Pope Francis will bring church leaders together to discuss the crisis. And then the bishops voted down a symbolic resolution asking for the Holy See to release all documents in the scandal surrounding former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick. What happened, and what does this mean for the future of this crisis? I spoke with Father Raymond D'Souza, a regular Register contributor in Baltimore, where we were both covering the USCCB meeting.
Well, Father, we spent a number of weeks in Rome not too long ago attending and covering the Synod, and here we are in Baltimore covering the meeting of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. The clergy sexual abuse crisis was a bit of an overshadow for both of those events. First, your thoughts on the Synod and from that perspective coming here to Baltimore.
Well, the reason that the sexual abuse crisis is relevant in both places is not just because the Synod was about young people, and therefore this is dealing with young people, but because at the heart of the controversies now in different parts of the Church is how have bishops handled it? Have they defended the interests and the safety of victims? Have they protected the holiness of the Church, or have they, in a kind of favoritism to priests or other bishops who are accused, engaged in avoiding the topic, or even worse, covering up the topic? So the bishop's behavior, bishop's conduct, bishop's governance has really been at the head of it, at the top of the concerns. And so whenever bishops gather, it doesn't matter if it's a synod or a plenary meeting of a bishop's conference. I mean, they could be getting together for a fitness class, and this topic's going to arise. Now, add in specific things like the situation of Cardinal McCarrick, and the American bishops are going to have to speak about it in a more direct way. But, you know, the Canadian bishops, I'm from Canada, they had a bishop meeting in September. They'd been working on a revision of their sexual abuse guidelines and protocols for 4 years, and they were approving it, which they did at that meeting. But if they hadn't, it would have been on the agenda anyway. This is just, whenever bishops gather, this is a topic. It's not to be the dominant topic, but it is a topic. And so now, the American situation was different because the bishops announced in the late summer, early fall, that the primary, almost singular, but not quite singular, goal of this meeting was to deal with the sexual abuse crisis insofar as it touched on how bishops are held to account. And so they had some proposals on the table for that. You'll recall that a very important meeting took place in September. Cardinal DiNardo, president of the American bishops, asked the Holy Father for an investigation into Cardinal McCarrick called an apostolic visitation. And he was told that that would not happen. But the Pope made a counterproposal, which was that the bishops not have this meeting at all, business meeting, and have a retreat instead. So that was, now, none of us paid a lot of attention, or as much attention as we should have, I guess, in September, to the fact that the Pope really didn't think that the American bishops should be debating proposals, you know, new procedures, protocols, on sexual abuse and do something else instead, namely have a retreat. We didn't take that as seriously, but of course, as now we've discovered, that actually was a very serious disagreement that created the, I would say, the original derailing of this meeting. But although the meeting is now officially a complete failure in that it was meant to propose to approve these protocols, It's not a complete failure because some of the discussions here that have gone on, I think, are actually a promising beginning or a promising change from what we're used to seeing at meetings of bishops.
Obviously, the bishops here in Baltimore were shocked, stunned on Monday when the announcement was made just minutes into the start of the gathering here that the Holy See was requesting they not do these votes. So looking at that, we moved to the next day where there was a lot of discussion that, yes, we want to talk about these topics. And then, of course, on Wednesday, we had the defeat of a resolution relating to a request for the Holy See to release all documentation pertaining to Cardinal McCarrick, or former Cardinal McCarrick. Given that through 3 days of upheaval, of turmoil, what do you think the bishops are going to be able to say when they go home to their people?
Well, I think what is going to happen, which is why I say I think there's some good news here, is that they'll tell the people the truth. And this has been a long-standing complaint, is that that when things are said on these difficult issues, the full truth isn't told, or it's shaded, or something is said which is not really wrong but obscures more than it reveals. Two statements I'll just highlight here is Cardinal DiNardo, the president of the Bishops' Conference, said on Monday, "I don't understand why this was done. I don't think it's a collegial action, and I'm not happy about it." I don't think, you've been covering these more comprehensively than I, that a president of the American Conference of Bishops, or for that matter any conference of bishops, has ever said something so blunt. Even though this is not the first time that someone has been upset or puzzled or opposed to a direction from Rome. If on Monday Cardinal DiNardo had begun the meeting by saying, "You know, brothers, we received a communication from from the Congregation of Bishops, and actually now on reflection I think it would be much better if we did something totally different," that would have been not out of keeping with how things were handled in the past, but it was not even an option today because you have to be more transparent. Another word for that is to tell the truth. So now this resolution, which was basically a resolution, it was defeated largely because many of the bishops said, look, the Pope has said he's going to review these documents and he's going to tell us what he finds. So this is kind of piling on and it's kind of a little bit disrespectful. And Bishop Beigler, Wyoming, I believe, said, "This motion is an act of distrust in the Holy Father." Now, set aside whether it is or it isn't, the fact that a bishop would say that about a motion that a brother bishop has proposed and that one-third of them eventually voted for, that's a level of frankness. So what are they going to tell the people when they go back? They're going to say, look, we had a proposal, did the best we could in a short time. The Vatican didn't like it or didn't think we should do it and told us we shouldn't, so we didn't. But we're not happy about that. And now we have this important meeting that the Holy Father has called with bishops from around the world, bishops' conference presidents, and hopefully something good will come from that. And that's why I say there's good here, because instead of everybody pretending to agree or agreeing for the sake of agreeing, even though there's significant issues, the differences were aired. And the discussion that took place on Tuesday and Wednesday in the Bishops' Hall has never, in the living memory of anybody in that room, occurred before. Now, let me not make the claim too strongly. There have been disagreements on important issues, and there have been contested votes and things defeated. So I'm not suggesting that there's never been a proper discussion. I had one bishop say to me that this was the healthiest plenary meeting he'd been to, not because of the motions passed, because in fact the critical motions weren't even put to a vote, but because of the discussion that took place. And so I think that it's actually relatively easy. I'm not downplaying the amount of work that went into those proposals, but it's relatively easy to propose a motion, a protocol, a procedure, and vote on it. It's very hard to change a culture. You can't say we have a motion to change a culture, but in the culture of the bishops of the United States. And so that's noteworthy and could even be, looking back, an important moment.
There seem to be two tensions sort of pulling on the body of bishops here. The first is the impulse, understandable, to tried to get to the heart, to a solution to the McCarrick crisis, which really is nesting in this problem right now. The other is the impact of the letter of the former nuncio to the United States, Carlo Maria Vigano. What impact do you think that that letter from Archbishop Vigano and the subsequent ones has had on these deliberations here?
Well, it's very clear that everyone in the room who spoke, what they think in the privacy of their hearts, I don't know, is in favor of finding out what happened in Cardinal McCarrick's long career and whether what Archbishop Vigano says is true. Now, others, I myself have written repeatedly, I think it was a mistake for Archbishop Vigano to ask the Holy Father, not to ask, demand, I suppose, the Holy Father to resign. I think many of the things he wrote in his original testimony were reckless and even could be slanderous. But he did make some claims, and on the specifics of the key claims about what was known in Rome about Cardinal McCarrick at certain times, he seems more to be correct than incorrect, leaving some specifics aside. So there's good reason to investigate. I mean, and there seems to be a widespread agreement that even though the manner of how Archbishop Vigano made his claims is not well received by all, although some have received it well, but there seems to be an agreement that they want to get to the bottom of it. And I think that the Vigano testimonies have made the question essential to answer. It's possible to imagine that after Theodore McCarrick resigned from the College of Cardinals in July and was asked by the Holy Father, told to live a life in seclusion, no more public ministry, not to be seen anymore, confined to a Franciscan friary in Kansas, that people could have said, well, okay, I mean, look, he's been punished, we're never going to hear from him again, we're never going to see him again, that's the end of it. And we're sorry that it took as long as this to discover it, but we've done the best we can. The Vigano letters made that not possible, and so I'd say that's the impact of it. And they will get to the bottom of it one way or the other. The motion failed, but a third of the bishops voted in favor of it, and probably another third didn't vote for it, not because they were against the information being provided in a public way, but they didn't think it was necessary and perhaps even bad manners to make this motion. And the Holy See will know that if two-thirds of the American bishops want this information in a timely fashion to be somehow made public, that they will not be able just to say no, because that's not sustainable in terms of the temperature of the United States and perhaps also the temperature in Rome.
One of the arguments against this resolution was to that very point, that in early October, the Holy See released a statement that a documentary investigation is going on and that those documents will be coming forth at some point. This vote today, one of the warnings, as you said, from Bishop Beagler and others, could be interpreted as not a rebuke, but certainly a statement to some degree of questioning about the veracity or certainly the alacrity of how the Holy See is dealing with this. Are we seeing this frustration playing out?
Yes. Well, what the Holy See said on October the 6th was they were going to review all the documents in their files, basically in Rome and in the Nunciature in Washington, and they would make the findings public. The motion asked for the documents, which you could say is a basic implication that we're not that interested in what you find there, what we want to discover for ourselves. So Bishop Beagler was correct to say that this was an act of distrust because, there's an implication that we don't trust you to get the information out. Cardinal Supich, who has been very active in this meeting, basically articulating as best as he thinks, I would assume, what the Holy See would like. And he made that immediate intervention at the beginning of the meeting, which had the effect basically of saying that all the rest of you are surprised, but I'm not, because I'm the Pope's inside man. I presume that was the point of the intervention, because it was so unusual when everybody else was shocked.
And just to be clear, it was immediately after the announcement from Cardinal DiNardo that the no votes are going to be taken. He went to a microphone, talked about that, and then made a proposal that the bishops reassemble essentially in March after the upcoming February meeting. So there was a sense, at least in a lot of observers, that he not only had foreknowledge of this, but was prepared to make the suggestion.
Well, that's not a sense of observers. That's a fact. I mean, everybody else was wondering what exactly was said, and he had a presentation. Now, there's nothing wrong with somebody being consulted ahead of time. It created an odd dynamic, because when everybody was in utter shock that he was ready to go. But anyway, since then, he's been speaking very often at this meeting and making points that have been more or less well received, depending on what the subject was. But he said of this motion that the Holy Father said, we're going to follow the truth wherever it leads us. And I think Cardinal Supich's exact words in the discussion was, the Pope has said he's going to tell the truth and we should take him at his word. Now, that, I almost fell off my chair, because could you imagine ever a cardinal in the United States getting up and saying, the Pope has told us he's going to tell us the truth and we should take him at its word? I mean, that was just sort of taken for granted. Even to think it would be thought to be disrespectful. Now, he was defending Pope Francis, but it's the kind of defense that is not usually required. So, yes, that motion, I think, was received or understood by the bishops as being, this is something different. This is, however it's phrased, whatever the specifics of it are, this is a statement that, we're not happy and we're not entirely confident that you are going to do what we think needs to be done. And that also being out in the open is quite a remarkable development, I would say.
When we come back, I continue my conversation with Register contributor Father Raymond D'Souza. This is Register Radio.
Have you heard who's reading the Register? Why, it's Marcus Groda.
I believe EWTN's National Catholic Register is unique from other newspapers in that it not only is committed to reporting the news from the world and the church and our faith, but it does so through the lens of the faithfulness of our Catholic Church.
For a 3-month free subscription to the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 3 months free banner, or call 1-800-421-3230.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, the Register's senior editor and co-host for Register Radio. I'm filling in for Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio, while she's away on maternity leave. We return to my conversation with Father Raymond D'Souza in Baltimore during the Bishops' Conference meeting last week.
On Monday, one of the terms that was bandied about, and this is certainly a term that you and I heard quite a bit also in Rome during the synod, synodality. And the question was asked of Cardinal DiNardo, is this an example of synodality? And his answer was terse, essentially saying, no, this probably isn't what we were thinking of synodality. And some have noted that the Germans seem to have a fairly free hand with an interpretation of synodality, but the U.S. bishops don't.
Well, I think we have to be very specific here, because I have seen it said, well, the Germans get to do what they want, and, the Italians get to do what they want, but the Americans don't. I think that's correct. Synodality, consultation, decentralization, local decision-making, whatever you want to call it, has certainly been a hallmark of Pope Francis, and certainly the synod, kind of, last few days were consumed by that. But the Pope has made very clear on this specific issue of judging and disciplining bishops that he and he alone will do it, including the Bishop of Bling, who I must say, I'm embarrassed, I don't remember his name, but it's just his nickname. Early on in the pontificate of Pope Francis, he was disciplined by Pope Francis.
A German bishop.
A German bishop. Yes, Bling is not a German word, so that was his English nickname. I don't know in German what his nickname was. But on financial indulgence, overspending.
And a rather ostentatious way of looking at the world.
Right. So, but on issues, I mean, the Pope has removed, he just lay aside two bishops in Chile, which is not unprecedented, but certainly unusual. Certainly two in one day is unusual. He's removed the Bishop of Memphis, Bishop Holly, who's present for this meeting, which has created some awkwardness in their receptions without giving a reason why. He removed the Auxiliary Bishop of Tegucigalpa, the right-hand man of Cardinal Oscar Rodriguez Maradiaga, his close advisor. So he's removed bishops, but he's made it very clear, and the Archbishop of Guam, who's actually part of the American Episcopal Conference, but is understandably not present. The Pope has made very clear on these issues, he and he alone is going to judge. When the Chilean bishops 3 years ago asked him not to appoint Bishop Barros, he refused to listen to them until he changed his mind. And then not only did he sack Bishop Barros, but seven others, and got the resignations of everybody else. So on this issue, it's very clear, and I think canonical concerns notwithstanding, at the heart of what we saw here this week is that on this issue, the Pope doesn't think that bishops' conferences should be setting up procedures and protocols and commissions. If there's a problem with the bishop, the Holy Father will look into it and will handle it. And we've seen that repeatedly. Chile, the most spectacular example, but not only there. We've seen it in three or four different cases. And on the return trip from Ireland, the Pope actually laid this out on the airborne press conference when he was asked about these questions. And he said, well, referring to his own legislation that he'd put into effect about 2 years ago about how which congregations in Rome should examine bishops when they were accused of bad governance or misconduct themselves. And he said, well, we put that into place, and it's his own legislation, but I don't think it's really feasible, he said. Now, he said, what I prefer to do is that when a case comes, I will appoint investigators, a jury of his, you know, as he called it then on the plane, and then they'll tell me what their findings are, and I'll make a decision.
So given that, the way it was handled, a letter from the Congregation for Bishops that was delivered on the eve of this gathering. First, is there, in your view, a message there to the U.S. bishops, or is there a need for perhaps an awareness of how that might be perceived by American Catholics?
Well, I don't think that. I wouldn't say that there is a lack of awareness how it would be perceived, because leave aside American Catholics, you have to know that if you tell someone less than 24 hours after the entire episcopate gathers, you can't do what you're going to do, you know that's not going to be well received. I mean, so it can't have been that that they didn't know the gravity, the Holy Father did. Now, the nuncio was in Rome on the Saturday before the Sunday letter to give a report. Why it was left so late, why there wasn't more consultation, I don't know. That I don't know, and no one who does know has shed any light on that. You wrote in your own analysis of this, Matthew, that it could be read as a deliberate humiliation, because that was certainly one plausible explanation. But we don't know that for a fact. It could be read that way. I would like to think it wasn't that way, and I think it's better to presume that there was some kind of foul up in communications, or people weren't paying attention, or something went wrong, rather than, because no one would have wanted what actually happened on Monday. But it does require an explanation, and I think that the Holy Father himself would be entitled to ask his principal collaborators, okay, what just happened in Baltimore caused a lot of ill will towards me in the American hierarchy, and likely in the American Catholic Church. So that is not good. So what happened here that caused that to happen, and let's see if we can remedy it. And but yes, I don't. I mean, it would not be at all in Pope Francis's interest to do it the way that he did. So let's assume that there was some constraint that forced his hand in a way that we don't know. But again, when we don't know, it gives rise to people being suspicious. So,
in the little time we have left, what do you see as the road ahead, both for the U.S. bishops, but also for the way that Pope Francis is going to be handling this entire crisis?
Well, the stakes, if I might say, about the February meeting, the Holy Father with all the presence of all the bishops' conferences of the world are very high now, because now what has been said is, okay, you Americans were kind of ahead of others. You had developed all these systems and protocols, and we said, wait, because now we're going to do it together. Well, so you have to do it together now. I'm not sure what's going to happen. I mean, John Paul, to my knowledge, the only precedent for this was a meeting of the Episcopal Conference presidents, I think, in the late 80s or 90s. I could be wrong. So it's not a common thing that's done. But bishops' conference presidents, are not CEOs of a company. You can't just say, sign here, and they go back and implement it. Each Episcopal conference has to find its own way. With sex abuse, the difficulty is that it's a canonical and moral moral sin, but it's also a civil crime. So every country's laws are different. So what principles are going to be enunciated there? That's going to be very difficult. The lesson for the Holy See out of Baltimore, November 2018, is that everything has to be well prepared. There can't be these kinds of last-minute surprises. To return to the Synod, Matthew, there can't be a repeat of what happened at the Synod where, you know, a topic, synodality, which you mentioned, which had not received any sort of advance treatment, all of a sudden became very prominent, and people said, what's going on here? You can't have a repeat of what happened here where the main part of the agenda is abrogated 24 hours before it begins or less than that. It has to be clear what is on the agenda, what are we going to discuss, what are the concrete proposals. It's not reasonable to ask the bishops' conference presidents around the world to show up on a Tuesday morning, be given a dossier, and say, let's vote on it Tuesday afternoon or Wednesday. So I think the lesson for the Holy See is the Holy Father is chosen, and there's no reason to think it's a bad decision to have this summit in February. It has to be well prepared.
Thanks so much for listening this week to Register Radio on EWTN. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Be sure also to listen to our podcasts. On behalf of Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief and co-host of Register Radio, and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Until next week.